Welcome to Garden DC, the podcast about everything gardening in the Washington, D.C. and Mid-Atlantic region. I'm your host, Kathy Gents. I'm the editor of Washington Gardener magazine, and we're aimed at gardening enthusiasts, people who grow everything from edibles to ornamentals, natives to exotics. If it grows in our area, that's what we talk about. This week on the Garden DC podcast, we're joined by Andrew Bunting. He is the Vice President of Public Horticulture with the Pennsylvania Horticultural Society in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Welcome, Andrew.
Thanks for having me.
We are going to be talking all things hydrangea today, but before we dive into that, I wanted to ask a little bit about you and your background, and I know that you were with Atlanta Botanical Garden, Chicago Botanic Garden, but I have to ask the question we often ask on the Garden DC podcast, which is, Andrew, were you born with chlorophyll in your veins?
Yeah, probably. From a relatively young age, like my mother, who lives in New Jersey now, she always gardened. And then as a kid, I think that's how I got attracted to it. I also had both my maternal and paternal grandfathers were both farmers, one in Illinois and one in Nebraska. So I think that probably influenced me in one way or another. And then I was lucky enough to go to a high school that was pretty big in the northern suburbs of Chicago that had some I think three different horticulture classes in high school. So that kind of piqued my interest. And then I went to a little junior college, Joliet Junior College in Northern Illinois. And it was through there that I had to do two internships. And my first internship was at the Morton Arboretum, which is west of Chicago. And the other was at the Chicago Botanic Garden, which is north of Chicago. And it was through those internships that I really fell in love with kind of the public horticulture field. And as you mentioned, I currently work at Pennsylvania Horticultural Society. Prior to that, worked at Atlanta Botanical Garden. And prior to that, Chicago Botanic Garden. And then for a long time, I worked at the Scott Arboretum at Swarthmore College, where I was there for, I think, 27 years in total.
Looking at your resume, I see that you did internships in New Zealand and Somerset, England. Can you talk about those a little
bit? Sure. Yeah. I came to the Scott Arboretum in 1986 and worked for 3.5 years, but it had always been a dream to work somewhere foreign. So when I was at the Scott Arboretum, I met Penelope Hobhouse, who's a world famous garden designer, has written many, many books on garden design, color in the garden, all sorts of horticultural books. So she was giving a lecture at the Scott Arboretum probably in the late 80s. And I must have had a conversation with her. And she said, you know, why don't you come over to England and work with me at Tintinhull House? So she was living at Tintinhull House in Somerset in the southwest of England, which is National Trust property. And because she was doing so much lecturing and writing, she hired me and another young American to help her in the garden. And then I had also had a friend who had been to New Zealand, and he met Gordon Collier, who's a really well-known garden designer there, who had a garden on the North Island in Taihape called Totoki Point. So I corresponded with him, and this is long before the internet. And he said, you know, if you want, you know, when you finish up your stint in England, which was about, I think that was about 10 months, he said, you know, if you can make it to New Zealand, you can come and work with me for 3 months. So I did that. I left England and then flew to New Zealand and spent 3 months there. And then ultimately came back to Swarthmore. So I'd, at that point, been gone over a year in total. And I did a number of things. And actually, kind of the first job to kind of restart back in the Swarthmore area. I worked at Chanticleer for about a year and a half when it was transitioning from a private estate to a public garden.
And did that experience gardening overseas, and then I would call New Zealand way overseas, right? Would that have changed the way you garden? Did it?
Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah, it opened my eyes to kind of, you know, incredible breadth of garden styles. So one of the things I did when I was in England is I bought a used car, and almost every single weekend I would go to, whether it be National Trust gardens or private gardens or Royal Horticultural Society gardens, mostly in England, but also in Wales and Scotland. And I think I counted that I visited 140 gardens in that 10 months. So I saw everything from, you know, kind of wild Robinsonian type gardens, shade gardens, plantsman's gardens, you know, Tudor style gardens, you know, formal, informal, grand estate type gardens and so on. And then when I went to New Zealand, there I would say the style was either kind of an English style or kind of more of a wild, kind of natural, native New Zealand garden style. So both in England and in New Zealand, my eyes were really open to kind of the depth and breadth of plants in general. Because like in New Zealand, they can grow everything from, you know, Mediterranean plants from South Africa or Chile or the Mediterranean, or they can grow a lot of, you know, more northern, cold tolerant temperate plants. So, you know, I really saw such a variety of garden styles, but also realized that, you know, the plant world is vast. And I met a lot of, you know, serious designers. You know, it was that year in England that I met, I lived with at Penelope Hobb House at Tintin Hall House. I met Rosemary Very, Christopher Lloyd, Pam and Sybil, who were the head gardeners at Sissinghurst at the time, John Brooks, Nori and Sandra Pope, who were at Hadspin House at the time. So it's like I met, you know, what's still considered today kind of the who's who of gardening dignitaries in England. So that was amazing as well.
Those are the names of many legends.
Yes.
In gardening, and many of us will be like turning green with envy right now, Andrew.
Person I didn't meet that I wished I had met when I was in England, and he was still alive at the time, was Graham Stuart Thomas, who had written those great books mainly on perennials. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but it sounds like you did not let moss grow under your feet. You took advantage of those learning opportunities.
Yeah, it was a full horticultural immersion that year.
Before we dive into hydrangeas, I want to also ask about your home garden currently, and then maybe talk a little bit about a typical work day at PHS for you.
Okay, sure. So I live in Swarthmore, which is where the Scott Arboretum is. So that's how I kind of ended up there. And I've owned my house, which looks like just like a little English stone cottage. It's about a third of an acre, which is small, but big enough for me. And it's gone through many, many transformations and kind of iterations of gardening over the years. Like the front was kind of a cottage at one point, cottage garden, and then it was kind of a wild meadow-esque garden, and now it's a gravel garden, so that's kind of my newest garden. The garage I turned into kind of an indoor-outdoor space that I call the summer house. In the back, I grow a lot of unusual annuals and tropicals, both in containers and then in the beds as well. The very back, there's a woodland garden. And about 10 years ago, I approached my neighbors with the idea that I would create this fairly large vegetable garden at the back of their property. So we live on Vassar Avenue, so we call it Vassar Farm. It's 40 by 100. It's big. It's four kind of quadrants. There's chickens back there. There's compost. There's some really great Asian persimmons that are pretty bountiful in the fall. I would say, if anything, I enjoy collecting plants, but I also enjoy garden design as much as I do the collecting of unusual plants. So, you know, when I left, I went to Chicago Botanic Garden, Atlanta Botanical Garden. I was gone almost 5 years. I kept the house, so it was kind of fortuitous when I got this position at the Pennsylvania Horticultural Society that I could just kind of move back into my old place. And Josh Cucciano is a horticulturist at the Scott Arboretum. He lived there, so it was in pretty good hands while I was away. So I guess that takes us up to, we call it PHS, or most people around here call it PHS, the Pennsylvania Horticultural Society. And, you know, one of the things I do love about my position there is that every day is different. I would say there's no typical day. My purview is all of our public landscapes and public gardens. So, you know, a typical day might be, when we're typically at our offices, we've been working from home for the most part, would be to go out and maybe go to some of our public spaces that are nearby. So it might be going to, say, the Azalea Garden or the gardens at the Rodin Museum or the Philadelphia Museum of Art or Logan Square, maybe over to the gardens at the Eastern State Penitentiary. And then, you know, I'd probably have a meeting, meeting or two. Nowadays, it's lots of meetings. In my position, I get involved in a lot of things like this podcast. I do a lot of media type work, whether it's an interview for a podcast or, I just gave a lecture for Smithsonian Gardens on hydrangeas and did one prior to that on, I guess that was magnolias. And then I do a lot of writing too. So I write a local every 2 weeks for the local newspaper, the Swarthmorean, that has now been somewhat syndicated. And then I do another one monthly for the New Jersey Gardener, which is it's a free paper, but it's given away at garden centers. And then I do one for Ball Publishing, for Green Profit. I think that's quarterly. So, I'd say, part of any day would probably be some media related work. And then I have a small team that oversees our pop-up gardens. So we have two gardens that are in Philadelphia that also have a food and beverage partner. So they're kind of a restaurant and a garden combined. And then I have another team that oversees kind of urban design. So I would probably be involved with them at some point in any given day. And then we also, where I am today, is we have a public garden north of Philadelphia called Meadowbrook Farm, which is an old estate garden. So depending on the day, I might be up here as well. And because I'm vice president of public horticulture, a lot, I would say almost anything that has to do with ornamental horticulture, a lot of either that involvement, whether it's with our education team, which we call audience engagement, I might get be involved with them on a project or something. We do have a whole team that's more kind of vegetable gardening through our community gardens team. So they would handle more of the community garden, vegetable gardening, subject matter, kind of expert aspects of PHS. So, it might be a donor meeting. It could, any day is, I would say, always different and always really interesting.
And I am a big fan of those pop-up gardens.
Oh, good.
I think the name is so funny, though, because I feel like all gardens pop up.
Yeah. Well, some of these, the original idea with the pop-ups is that they were to be kind of a one-year ephemeral garden, and then just, they'd be done at the end of the year. And then we did those for a while where they were true pop-ups. And then our new model is if it can work out to have a restaurant partner. So they also become good fundraising vehicles for PHS. And then they're also really interesting gardens. So the one at South Street is more, I would say that's kind of urban chic with lots of tropicals. And then the one in Manayunk is at the base of an old kind of rusted train shed. And so that one's more Pennsylvania native ecosystems we have over there.
Interesting. Yeah, I haven't been to the one with the natives. I'll have to
Yeah,
check that
that one
out this
just
summer.
opened in the, I guess in September of last year.
Okay. Something to look forward to
Yep.
this summer. And we'll be talking about the other big late spring, early summer occurrence, the Philadelphia Flower Show in a bit. But
Sure.
now let's focus on hydrangeas
Okay.
and everything about them and all their relatives and all of that stuff. And we're going to cover that right on our podcast in half an hour, right?
Right, let's do
It's going to be a race through
it.
hydrangeas. I was going to say it's only a tiny topic or something. So, to start off with hydrangeas, maybe let's focus on the native ones to start. How about that?
Yeah, that's a good group. Yeah, there's most people when they think of hydrangeas think of the big ball-shaped ones, which are called hortensias or mop heads, or and they also come in the lace cap form. But there is a lot of great native hydrangeas. So even in our areas around, say, Washington, D.C., or up in the southeastern Pennsylvania area, if you went out into the woods, you would probably come across a species called hydrangea arborescens, which is called the smooth hydrangea. And that actually, it'll grow in deep shade, but actually flowers better the more sun you give it. So you've probably, probably the most ubiquitous, and for good reasons, because it's probably one of the best hydrangeas on the planet. Hydrangea arborescens Annabelle is a selection of the native smooth hydrangea. It has beautiful white flowers. And both hydrangea arborescens and hydrangea paniculata, which is an Asian species, bloom on new wood. So that means that you could either just leave them as is and not prune them, and then the shrub would just gradually get a little bit bigger each year. Or, like when I was at the Scott Arboretum, we would prune them back to maybe 6 inches or so in March. It sent out all new stems up to about 4 feet tall. And then in July, you would get these big white heads. And Annabelle is great because it starts out kind of lime green, goes to pure alabaster white, fades back to lime green, and then those heads turn kind of a tawny brown, which can be ornamental for the winter. And it's also super hardy. Like Annabelle is probably one of the most commonly used hydrangeas in the Chicagoland area. I would put in my top five hydrangeas, and I would probably put in my top 10 shrubs, period, just because of the long bloom season. And then, it was theorized that kind of the holy grail of the hydrangea world for a while was to create a pink Annabelle. So Tom Rainey, who's a famous plant hybridizer with North Carolina State University, but works in Western North Carolina, he kind of charged some of his grad students to go out in the woods and see if they could just find a native hydrangea grown in the woods that just had the slightest amount of pink. And they figured if they could find a pink one, they could do a number of back crosses and continue to pull out that pink or accentuate that pink color. And that's how Invincible Spirit was developed, which is an arborescence. And now there's a whole series, kind of Invincible series, where there's ones that are kind of the original soft pink to ones that are really more kind of almost like a purplish burgundy pink. So kind of the whole range from light to dark. And there's probably about six of those. And then, of course, everybody wants ones that are shorter. So there's a new one called Limetta, which is kind of a diminutive form of Annabelle. So, Annabelle has always been a great hydrangea. Now there's been this breakthrough with kind of Invincible Spirit series, Limetta. And then there's also one one of the drawbacks of Annabelle, although to me it's not that big of a drawback, is a lot of people don't like when they're in flower and we get, say, a thunderstorm, and they tend to splay open, like a peony might kind of splay open. Mm-hmm. So what was also suggested is that maybe somebody do some hybridizing to make one with more sturdy stems. So there's one called Incredible, which has a flower head that's even bigger than Annabelle. It's like the size of a man's hand. And it's, probably, like 6 to 7 inches across. And it has supposedly has stronger stems. So it doesn't tend to splay open like Annabelle might do. And Annabelle tends to splay open more if it's grown in a bit of shade. If it's in sun, the stems seem to be a little stronger.
Yeah, and I've been trialing, when you talked about the Invincible series, I have Mini Mauvette.
Yeah,
which is, it's a pretty neon pink. It's pretty close to that end. And then I also have Wee White.
Yes.
Which I just got, and that's a tiny white one, and that's more pure white, whereas Annabelle is almost, I'm going to say, towards the ivory end of white.
Right, that's right. Mm-hmm. And then there are other arborescence cultivars. There's a double one called Haze Starburst. There's some people call them a different species, but Hydrangea arborescens radiata, which is sometimes listed as a subspecies. Those have kind of a whitish underside of the leaf, which is pretty. So there are others. Those are kind of the ones that you mentioned and I mentioned, kind of are the breadth of Hydrangea arborescens. And then the other native that people really like is the oak leaf Hydrangea mm-hmm. cordifolia. And that's not truly native in our area. You have to go more farther south into, say, parts of Georgia, northern Florida, Alabama is where you would see Hydrangea cordifolia truly growing in the wild. Again, it's in the wild, it's a native understory plant. But again, if you bring it into more sun, you get better flowering. And then it's called the oak leaf hydrangea because the leaf, in fact, looks kind of like a red oak leaf. And then it also gets really good fall color, kind of a reddish purple. Most hydrangeas just turn kind of yellowish brown in the fall. So it's good for that. It does not bloom on new wood like arborescens and paniculata. So I would say if you need to prune it, just kind of judiciously prune it. Don't do any severe pruning to it. Depending on the cultivar, it can get, fairly large, say 8 feet tall, 8 feet wide. There are many cultivars. My favorite, handful of favorites would be Snow Queen, which has really nice upright white, cone-shaped panicles of flowers. Snowflake has these kind of hose double flowers that make them so heavy that they become a pendant and hang downwards. And that's really a nice hydrangea to grow kind of spilling over a wall. There are some more diminutive types like peewee and Sykes dwarf and Ruby Slippers. Ruby Slippers is an introduction from the U.S. National Arboretum in Washington, D.C., and it's small, kind of, maybe 3 to 4 feet tall, and then the white flowers ultimately turn kind of a carmine pink. And then there's another one that kind of quickly turns to pink called Amethyst, which is really nice if you can find it. And then there's a small one that has yellow leaves called Little Honey. And Little Honey, for that to be successful, if you give it too much sun, it turns green, or actually scorches, I should say. If you give it too much shade, it turns green. So what you really want to do is give it kind of edge of the woods or dappled sunlight, like under, say, a honey locust or a Kentucky coffee tree where it's not a deep shade. And then you really get that vibrant, kind of butter yellow coloration to the leaves. But like all the hydrangeas in general, there's probably no shrub in my lifetime that has gone through such an incredible renaissance in the gardening world than hydrangeas. And it all happened, I don't know, 20 something years ago when Martha Stewart featured hydrangeas on the cover of her magazine, Martha Stewart Living. And it was from that day forward that the world of hydrangeas really exploded. And it's, you know, if you look at any of these groups, whether it's arborescens, the oak leaves, paniculata, macrophyllas, serratas, they've all like had this kind of rebirth, and there's been incredible plant selection and hybridizing work that continues to happen. Like we, Richard Hockey, he's the manager of plant evaluations at Chicago Botanic Garden. He did a hydrangea paniculata trial in like, you know, 20 years ago, maybe you could find five cultivars, maybe, of hydrangea paniculata. I think his trial had over 75 cultivars alone of hydrangea paniculata. And with back to the oak leaves, there's probably, if you were to collect them all, there's probably at least 30 cultivars of oak leaf hydrangea.
Well, thank you, Martha.
Yes.
Yeah. And I was going to say no thank you to Madonna. I don't know if you remember that press conference she gave a few years ago where a fan came up or somebody came up and gave her an armful of, I believe it was blue hydrangea blooms. And she was like on mic live and under her breath, she says, "I hate hydrangeas." She was like, and she kind of throat tosses them behind the table type of thing. I was like, yikes.
That comment does not seem to have affected their popularity.
No. Yeah. And everybody was bewildered by that. I was like, who hates flowers?
Yeah, exactly.
And they're such long lasting vase life. If you do cut them fresh and then it dried
the, that's as well. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that's pretty much infinity vase life right there for dried.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And they actually like hydrangea arborescens or paniculata. They're kind of dried flower heads in the garden, you know, will last well into kind of the next spring. So they also have kind of a staying power if you choose to leave them on the plant for winter effect.
I'm a very much procrastinator in snipping off last year's blooms, especially on the smooth hydrangea. I leave them practically till the new ones have formed. And then I go.
Right. Yeah. Me too.
And they're almost like, you know, little skeletons at that point, but they're still there. They're still marking where the blooms were. So I do want to talk about some of the climbing hydrangea family. So are they actually directly related to hydrangea, or is just that hydrangea?
You know, I haven't stayed completely up with the taxonomy of hydrangeas, but there's been talk, and I believe a lot of people now are putting almost everything that's in the Hydrangeaceae family in the genus hydrangea. But for the climbers, there is a true hydrangea, Hydrangea petiolaris, which is, it has little rootlets along the stem that allow it to cling to whether it be a tree trunk or a wooden fence or a cement chimney. And it grows skywards, and it has kind of lace cap flowers where it has more kind of showy, kind of four-parted florets around the outer edge of the flat top cluster. And then in the center, it's all the tiny fertile flowers where the seed would actually come from. And it has a really hand soap, sweet fragrance. And it has a beautiful kind of golden yellow fall color. Sometimes it takes a while to bloom. Like it can need to be 7 to 10 years old before it really gets good flowering. Mm. And then there is kind of a native version of the climbing hydrangea. It has a different genus called Decumaria. So it's Decumaria, Barbara. And it's found in southeastern parts of the United States, comes up into Arkansas and southern Illinois. And I actually saw it fairly recently growing in Alabama, and it was growing in standing water in a swamp, which is not a condition I would have thought it would tolerate. And it has, instead of having the showy flowers like you have on most hydrangeas, it's all fertile flowers. So it's kind of a dome of flowers, also fragrant, blooms in the summer, really fantastic, kind of almost like a ghostly, kind of whitish, yellow, creamy fall color, self-clinging as well. I have on the front of my house, I have a Daykumaria barbara. And actually in the back of my house, I'm sure I'm the only one in probably Pennsylvania that has one, and I got this from Heronswood years ago, I have the Asian counterpart to that of Daykumaria sinensis. And that, it looks very similar. It just has a slightly narrower leaf. And then there's my favorite of that whole group, and it's a mouthful, is Schizophragma hydrangeoides. So that means it's hydrangea-like. And that's called the Japanese hydrangea vine. And it, so if you give it good sun, it flowers better. And there's a cultivar called Moonlight. Like if you're going to, I mean, the straight species is nice. And what it does is it has kind of a flat top cluster of flowers. And then it has these single bracts that kind of, they almost look like they're hovering above or suspended above the flower or the foliage. They're almost kind of these like teardrop bracts. And so that's really pretty. If you grow the one that's called Moonlight, its claim to fame is it has those flowers, but it also has kind of this variegation where the leaf is kind of a pewter silver, but then the veins are dark green. So it creates this kind of beautiful mosaic effect on these heart-shaped leaves, self-clinging. The key with Moonlight is if you give it too much sun, that the variegation doesn't stand out. But if you give it too much shade, you don't get as good a flowering. So what I found is probably the best place to grow it is maybe, like I had one actually in the northwest corner of my house, and kind of that aspect got enough light to kind of, it was shady enough to give the good variegation and sunny enough to give the good flowering. And then if you live in like England, there's another genus called Pileostegia viburnoides, but that I've tried it here, and maybe in places like San Francisco or the Pacific Northwest you could grow it, but I don't believe it likes the heat and humidity of most of the eastern U.S.
And do you find, so you said it takes 7 to 10 years sometimes for the flowers, that climbing hydrangea are really slow to establish and get started on that climb?
Yeah, I would say they actually climb pretty quickly. It's this, and it's more with the hydrangea petiolaris that the flowering seems to be delayed. With Schizophragma, flowering can be pretty earlier when it's fairly juvenile, and same with the Daykumaria. So it's really more the what most people call the climbing hydrangea.
And so moving on to the big family, the mophead type,
yes,
or macrophylla, you mentioned the heat of the East Coast, and of course here our heat and humidity in the Mid-Atlantic. Do you find that for that group that we have smaller or less flowering, say, than they get in Michigan or Long Island from those mop heads?
I would say not necessarily. I think it's a tricky group, and I think the things that people need to know to understand why they're going to get flowers or not are a couple of things. One is, so hydrangea macrophylla is the group of the mop heads and the lace caps. There is hydrangea serrata, which is kind of a Japanese version that's everything's more diminutive. There's probably 1,000 cultivars. They'll actually take a lot of heat, like the, you know, American Hydrangea Society is based in Atlanta, and there's not many places in the country that are hotter and more humid than Atlanta, but the hydrangeas do really well there. They do well there. I think hydrangeas generally, while they can grow in alkaline soils, really can thrive in more of an acidic soil. The key in real hot places, say DC South, is to hydrangeas will actually do better with a bit more shade, and you have to really be mindful of watering during periods of drought. For people in where it's colder, and that can sometimes even include, say, the Philadelphia area, is not all hydrangea macrophyllas are created equally from a hardiness perspective. So you kind of have to know which ones are hardy enough. So like in Chicago, a lot of the macrophyllas just did not do well at all. They may have survived the winter, but what often would happen is they would die. They would be frozen to the ground. Mm. And because most hydrangea macrophyllas, you need stems that are at least 2 years old to get, you know, satisfactory flowering. They always had new wood, so they never really produced flowers. Now, there are some newer clones like Endless Summer and others that bloom on new wood, so that is a breakthrough in the hydrangea macrophylla world. Now, there does seem to be a perfect kind of climatic sweet spot for hydrangeas, and that is kind of a maritime type situation. So I've never been to Nantucket, but there's some hydrangea growers there, and I've seen pictures of like a hydrangea macrophylla that's literally like 10 feet round, and the entire thing is covered in flowers. And I go to Martha's Vineyard quite a bit because I have a colleague there, and macrophyllas do really well there, as do the serrata types. And what's interesting, and I'm sure the same is true as on Nantucket, is Martha's Vineyard is one of the most acidic places probably in the country, where the pH can be, you know, 4.5, 5. And so all the hydrangeas, it could be blue or pink, are all blue. Like they are like an intense, really intense blue because of the acidity. And that's another thing to kind of hydrangeas 101 that people need to know is the flower color is dependent upon the pH. So if it could be pink or blue, anything say 6.5 or less pH, you know, on the acidic side is going to be blue, and anything say 6.5, 7 or higher is going to be pink, like in Chicago, high alkalinity, high pH soils. The water also has high pH. So, you know, most of those hydrangeas there are pink, and places like Martha's Vineyard, they're all going to be blue. If it's a white hydrangea, it doesn't matter. It doesn't go, you know, it doesn't really turn another color. So that's important to know as well. And you can augment the soil, make your soil more alkaline or acidic, and try to change the pH of the soil and thus the flower color. Like the Scott Arboretum, which is more on the acidic side, we bought a hydrangea called Forever Pink, a macrophylla, and it was pink the first year, and then forever blue all the years forward from that.
Yeah, I totally relate. I bought Blue Jeans,
yep,
hydrangea, and it was blue the first year and pink forever since, because of I'm in an old brick house, and I'm pretty sure it's the brick that makes the soil alkaline.
Yeah, exactly. What often happens is people that plant them along their foundation, you know, most foundations are made out of cement, and the cement, the mortar of the cement, or just the how the cement is made, has a high level of alkalinity to it. So that's why often foundations have a high pH, so that and it can impact the acidity or the pH of the soil. Mm-hmm. And then the other group that's worth mentioning are the hydrangea serratas. So serratas are like a macrophylla. They both have lace cap, and the mop heads are hortensias, but everything is smaller in stature. So the plants themselves can be anywhere from like 3 to 6 feet tall, smaller leaves, smaller flowers, great for a smaller garden. And many of them have Japanese names like Miyamiye Murasaki or Kiyosumi, or there's several others that are, can be available either through mail order or a bit more of a specialty nursery. But what's great about that group is they have incredible hardiness. So if you live in places like, say, anywhere in New England, Chicago, Southern Wisconsin, they become a great alternative for the macrophyllas, which I would say there's a lot less hardiness in macrophylla than there is hardiness.
That's a great tip. And yeah, I was going to say that we always want what we can't have, right,
Right.
Andrew? I want that bright sky blue hydrangea, and that's just not going to happen for me without a lot of work. And then I have neighbors who are like, "How do you get your hydrangea so pink?" And I was like, "Let me tell you something." So, in our last few minutes together, let's talk a bit about the changes this year to the Philadelphia Flower Show and what people can expect.
Right. So, for the first time in 190 something years, the Pennsylvania Horticultural Society is almost 200 years old, and the flower show has been running fairly regularly since our inception. It will be out of doors. It's almost, at least for the last 20 years or so, it's been in the Pennsylvania Convention Center in the winter. But because of COVID-19, we've decided to have it out of doors at FDR Park, which is in the southern part of Philadelphia. It's right near the stadiums and just north of I-95 and close to the Philadelphia Navy Yard. So it's a great part of the city. It's in a 300-acre park that's an Olmsted Park, so same Frederick Law Olmsted who designed Central Park. So it's an old, grand, beautiful park. We'll be taking about 15 acres of it, so that seems relatively small, but it's actually bigger than where the footprint of the normal flower show. It'll be open June 5th to the 13th. You can go online and get timed tickets. It'll be, at a time of year that we don't typically have a flower show, so in June, so a time of year where there'll be, you'll get to see a lot of I think a bit more diversity of plants because of that, and just having more availability of plants from a wider range of nurseries. There's over 75 exhibitors. The theme is habitat. So however the exhibitor or designer might interpret that, and that I think there's quite a bit of latitude for interpretation.
It all sounds really exciting, and the 15 acres that you mentioned makes me think I might pack a change in shoes.
I would wear comfortable shoes. So it will be out of doors. There's going to be a lot of great food venues kind of scattered all over the site. And the park itself has some water features. So there's a kind of a classic old boathouse that has these beautiful Palladian arches. So that'll be kind of an epicenter, or I should say a focal point at one end of the flower show. There'll be a design district and kind of a plantsman's district. There'll be a lot of vendors that people are familiar with, but also some new vendors that will be highlighting plants for sale. When we do sell some plants when it's at the convention center in the winter, but again, we're limited because of the time of the year. So we have more opportunities this year to have kind of a wider or more breadth in the type of plant nurseries that we can offer at the show.
Yeah, and I'm taking a busload of Washington Gardener readers up,
Oh, good.
and we have the entire underneath of the bus that we can fill up with
Yeah,
plants.
I've been on bus tours like that. It's great because the undercarriage of a bus has quite a bit of space.
Yeah, and the fact that you can buy what you're seeing basically on display does
Yes.
make the outdoor and the June timing even more exciting for this year.
I think it's to me it's really exciting. It's something we've never done. So, that we have a good idea of how it's all going to turn out, but I think it's actually going to be even more spectacular than any of us could envision. Because I think there's just going to be so much. Well, one, I think people in general are going to be so excited to be doing something that seems, you know, more normal. And it's going to be out of doors. And so I think there'll be a good buzz about the flower show.
I agree. And I think so many of us are just ready.
Yes. You know,
we are past ready.
Right. Yeah. And things are moving in the right direction. And you know, people are feeling more safe to be out of doors in this type of situation. So I think it's, I think a lot of positive things are all coming together at the same time.
Well, thank you, Andrew. And thank you, PHS, for, you know, powering through and putting on a flower show at all this year. So that will be great. And also thank you for sharing your hydrangea tips and wisdom. And for some final thoughts, you had mentioned there are almost 1,000, right, introductions in the macrophylla. And, you know, I feel like I've been sent dozens of them to trial. Are there a few of the new introductions that you recommend?
Yeah. You know, to be, you know, tiny, let's, I might not even get the right name, but Tough Stuff is one that's more kind of, you know, again, more of a compact form. So I like that. I must be honest and say, I don't even have a macrophylla type in my yard. What I've really gravitated towards, and it's a group we actually didn't even talk a lot about, are the paniculatas. So the panicle hydrangeas is one of my favorite groups because they're tough as nails, can grow in full sun. I still like, it's been around a while, but it's a great clone called Limelight. Mm-hmm. But now there's a newer one. So if you need something that's a bit smaller for the yard, one called Little Lime. So I like that as well. And there's one called Little Lamb, I think, as well. But there's also been breakthroughs in that group where there's ones that are more pink, like Pinky Winky, which has probably been around for 10 years or so. And there's other kind of pinkish clones, whether they kind of start out pink and stay pink, or they start out white and fade kind of a deeper pink color.
And who can resist a name like Pinky Winky, right?
Exactly. Yeah, that was really good marketing.
Very good. So thank you for those suggestions, and looking forward to seeing you in June at the Flower Show.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Brunnera plant profile. Brunnera macrophylla, or Siberian bug gloss, is also known as the false forget-me-not due to its dainty blue flower sprays in springtime. The flowers are pretty, but the real reason you want this plant in your garden is that it is a perennial workhorse with many positive attributes. In fact, it was named Perennial Plant of the Year in 2012. This plant's foliage is rough textured and heart-shaped. The hairy texture of the leaves make it deer and rabbit resistant. It is not a native plant to the mid-Atlantic USA, but it is well-behaved and expands in a clump that can be divided and moved about every few years. The only maintenance need is a fresh application of organic mulch in early spring and to cut back the spent flowers, unless you want the plant to seed about a bit. Brunnera needs to be kept well-watered in its first year, but after that, it's quite drought-tolerant, making it a good choice for dry shade locations. It's also a great alternative or companion to other shade-loving foliage plants like hostas, heucheras, and caladiums. The old-fashioned Brunnera is straight to green, while the newer cultivars have a silver sheen or white variegation to their leaves. That makes this plant shine in the deep shade. These include Jack Frost, Looking Glass, and Silver Heart. There is even a chartreuse version named Diane's Gold. This versatile plant is a good ground cover as well as container plant. Brunnera, you can grow that.
Thank you.
What's new this week in the garden? Well, over at my community garden plot, the strawberries are starting to ripen. I've gotten a couple handfuls so far and expect to have many more next week, maybe even enough to make a strawberry shortcake or make a jam. We'll see. And the weather has been pretty dry and hot, so the cool season crops are on their way out. I'll be pulling out the broccoli. I'll be eating the last of the radishes and probably the last of the arugula and other lettuces. Some of the radishes I'm going to leave in to bolt. That means set flower and then form seed pods and then seeds. And if you check out the new issue of Washington Gardener Magazine, May 2021, you'll see an article I wrote on the bonus harvests of radishes. So they're edible at all of these stages, from baby seedling through to seed pod. So check out that article, and you'll want to let some of your radishes stay in the garden and bolt too to get some of those bonus harvests from them. And back in my home garden, I've received a few more boxes of sample plants, and one of them I was ecstatic to see included the ingredients for a knockout martini. This is the petite knockout martini, which is made from vodka, sparkling pomegranate beverage, and fresh lime juice. That sounds really yummy for a weekend treat. And I will be finding some spots and containers for those petite knockouts to go in. I also have trialing several annual plants and some veggies and some basil. So I'll be reporting back in future podcasts of how those trials go. I'm really excited in particular for a couple of the annual dianthus and the wave petunias that are in colors that I like, which means lots of purples, right? Because I am a purple girl. So upcoming events in the local gardening area for the DC, Maryland, Virginia, Greater Mid-Atlantic, if you're in my region, check out Gardens of Note. That's the Reston Garden Tour on Saturday, June 5th. And you can find out information about that and purchase your tickets online from Reston Corral, that's CHORALE.org. So as you can tell by that name, Gardens of Note, it is a music and garden tour. So it's a self-guided tour, including pop-up musical performances. That sounds like a lot of fun to do that afternoon. Another upcoming tour is with the Potomac Rose Society. They're having a tour of the Franciscan Monastery Rose Gardens and a group picnic, bring your own, afterwards if you want to stay and meet up with the Rose Society members. And then I am giving a talk for Fairfax County Parks Green Spring Gardens, and it is on attractive and lasting plant combinations. That's Saturday, June 12th at 11 a.m. And there's a nominal fee to about $18 per person. I think there might be a discount for the frogs, the Friends of Green Spring, but check that out. And you can find out more information and register through fairfaxcounty.gov/parks/parktakes. And the event code is CDV.OK4P. I believe that is the correct code. You can also just search on my name, Kathy Gentz, J-E-N-T-Z, or on Green Spring Gardens event site. So I also wanted to note that I've been doing a lot of garden touring myself and been posting albums of photos from those tours to the Washington Gardener Facebook page. So if you go to facebook.com/Washington Gardener Magazine and click on the photos and then the albums, you'll see albums of photos from several of the recent garden tours that I've been going on. And the latest one is the Beyond the Garden Gates garden tour. That's in downtown Frederick. It's a self-guided walking tour. And you go to celebratefrederick.com to sign up and get the online brochure for that. And that goes through Sunday, May 23rd, if you're interested in still catching the Frederick Beyond the Garden Gates garden tour. Happy gardening! Thank you. Thank you for listening to Garden DC. You can become a listener supporter for as little as 99 cents a month by going to anchor.fm/gardendc/support. Another way to support this podcast is to subscribe to our monthly digital publication, Washington Gardener Magazine. To do so, go to washingtongardener.com. Thank you. You can find Washington Gardener online at washingtongardener.com, on Twitter at WDCGardener, on Instagram at WDCGardener, and on Facebook.com at Washington Gardener Magazine.